From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Inner Sunset.
Outer Sunset.
North Beach.
Mill Valley.
Knob Hill.
Berkeley, California.
The Presidio.
Coming up, we'll hear how some hospitals plan to improve the way they serve older patients.
A lot of the stuff we do in medicine does more harm than good.
Then we'll hear your thoughts on Colin Kaepernick's national anthem protests, and we'll learn about when the NFL was first desegregated.
They were faced with a lot of abuse, knowing that there were potential targets for anyone who wanted to make a statement against integration.
And we'll be granted access to God's Gym, where an Oakland personal trainer pumps up bodies and spirits.
Sometimes, the pain we go through here.
Putting bodies on the line, today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Hospitals can be difficult and dangerous for elderly patients. Even if they recover from what sent them to the hospital in the first place, a third of patients over the age of 70 become disabled during their stay. That's why some hospitals are designing special units just for older patients. Anna Gorman reports.
A hospital's a terrible place to get a good night's sleep. 75-year-old Janet Prochaska was repeatedly woken up to get her vitals checked and blood taken. She was sick of it.
I wanted to be left alone. It was in the nighttime, of course. So I put the blanket over my head.
Prochaska had come to San Francisco General Hospital after a fall. Doctors treated her wounds and gave her medication for pneumonia. But she got worse. Time in the intensive care unit left her confused. She got weak from lack of sleep and exercise. Then she got a stomach infection.
I really felt like I'd been dealt a blow I didn't need, because I was really getting much better, and then all of a sudden, wham.
Interrupted sleep, unappetizing food, and days in bed are frustrating for anyone. But for older patients, even short hospital stays can cause lasting harm. Ken Kavinsky is a geriatrician at the University of California, San Francisco.
The older you are, the worse the hospital is for you.
Kavinsky says doctors often prescribe medicine that's unnecessary or inappropriate for older patients. They also frequently leave in catheters or IVs too long.
A lot of the stuff we do in medicine does more harm than good. And, you know, sometimes with care of older people, less is more.
Kavinsky says part of the problem is accountability. Hospitals face penalties from the federal government when patients fall or get bed sores, but there's no mandate to return patients home the same way they were before, physically or mentally.
Ice pack for 8-bed 1.
When I met Prochaska, she'd already been at the hospital for more than a week. After those unpleasant days in the ICU, she was moved to a special unit designed for seniors. It's called Acute Care for Elders. There are about 200 similar wards in hospitals around the nation. Dr. Edgar Pierluisi shows me around. He points out special floors to reduce glare and a dining room where patients can eat their meals together.
We do try to make things a little more home-like as much as one can in a hospital.
The geriatric wards try to get patients back home as quickly and independently as possible. To do that, they do common sense things, like making sure patients sleep well and get up and move around.
They seem like small things, but they're as important as getting the primary diagnosis right.
The heart of the unit is the team, which includes a doctor, a nurse, a pharmacist, and a social worker. They meet daily to make a plan for each patient. Today, nurse Annalene Nielsen gives an update on Prochaska.
She needs a little bit of rehab, but she's doing so much better transferring and walking.
But Nielsen says she's concerned because her patient is still confused and using a walker. Sitting in her hospital bed, Prochaska says she's worried too about staying independent when she gets out. She was living on her own and working as a special ed tutor until her fall. So Nielsen works with Prochaska daily to keep her mind and body active. They walk around the room and talk about family and pets, and I ask,
do you feel as strong as you were before?
Not quite, but I also feel like I'm getting there.
UC San Francisco's Kavinsky says hospitals need to start paying closer attention to how their older patients fare.
With an aging population, as we have more people in the hospital, this problem of hospital disability is going to increase, unless we figure out how to fix it.
He says special geriatric units like this one should be part of the solution.
That piece was produced for Kaiser Health News, a nonprofit news service reporting on healthcare policy and politics.
Thank you.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Earlier this month, we aired a documentary about what it means to protest during the national anthem. While others stand, San Francisco 49er Colin Kaepernick has been taking a knee to protest police brutality against people of color.
You know, I think it would be hypocritical for me to vote. You know, I said from the beginning I was against oppression, I was against the system of oppression. I'm not going to show support for that system.
We received some calls after that show, and we wanted to share this one with you.
I just want to say I think it's very appropriate for Colin Kaepernick to kneel as a means of protest during the national anthem. You know, he's explicitly stated, you know, this is not against the military, but this is for the treatment of black Americans by police officers. When you look at the contrasting protests, the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, you have a lot of Americans saying, why can't they have a peaceful protest? You know, why can't they open up a dialogue? And here you have Colin Kaepernick doing exactly that, the most peaceful form of protest I can imagine. And now America doesn't have a problem with that. And it kind of feels like, you know, the only way that black America can actually express themselves is in a very boxed-in way, which, you know, everyone else agrees with. And I don't think that's the meaning of protest. Protest isn't meant to agree with everyone else. It's meant to be a form of expression that you feel. So I think it's absolutely appropriate what he's doing.
Thanks for that call. And if you've got thoughts about demonstrations taking place during the national anthem, we want to hear them. Call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106 to share your thoughts with us. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Colin Kaepernick has been using his platform in the NFL to call attention to racial inequities. The NFL itself has not always been equitable for people of all races. And that's the subject of a book by San Francisco author Gretchen Atwood. It's called Lost Champions: Four Men, Two Teams, and the Breaking of Pro Football's Color Line. She came into our studios to talk about the book with KALW's Ben Trefney.
I'd like to start by talking about the man who seems maybe most akin to the Jackie Robinson of professional football. And this guy played college football with Jackie Robinson. His name's Kenny Washington. Who was he?
So Kenny Washington was probably UCLA's first big football star. He came to UCLA in 1936, and back then freshmen couldn't play on the varsity team. So he started in 1937, and the team had other good players, including Woody Strode, who was one of the receivers on the team. And they really helped bring UCLA football to, you know, national attention. And so then Jackie Robinson was recruited by UCLA predominantly as a football player, not as a baseball player.
He could play like three different sports.
Yeah, he ended up, I think, playing four sports. And he ended up starring on the UCLA football team with Kenny and Woody in 1939. But Kenny was really the acknowledged like star of the team even back then.
And so he ended up playing some professional football out of that, but not for the NFL.
True. So Kenny Washington and Woody Strode didn't have the opportunity to play in the NFL because the NFL had a ban on black players, an unwritten ban, but no players were signed or drafted until 1946. So after Kenny and Woody left UCLA, they played semi-pro ball with a West Coast league that had two teams in Los Angeles, and they both played for the Hollywood Bears.
So earlier in the 20th century, there were other black pro football players, right? But you're defining this as the first players in the modern era. So
yes.
What's the difference to you?
Well, early in pro football, the leagues, there weren't really any formed leagues like the NFL. The NFL started in the early 1920s. And before then, it really wasn't a sport that was organized. There was no money in it. It was run partly by gambling interests. Players would get signed to different teams from week to week. So it wasn't something where really a lot of people cared who played. It didn't have the prestige that the NFL would later have. But then by 1933, when George Preston Marshall got involved as one of the owners, they stopped signing black players and they cut all the few remaining black players that were in the league. And that was the case between 33 and 46.
And then in 46, that was when Kenny Washington and Woody Strode for the LA Rams, and then also Marion Motley and Bill Willis for the Cleveland Browns, they were signed to pro football contracts. But it wasn't the NFL. It was a different league, like a competing league.
Yes. So Bill Willis and Marion Motley were signed by the Cleveland Browns, which were a new team in a new league called the All-America Football Conference. And in fact, that was the conference that the San Francisco 49ers started out in. And the Browns and the 49ers had the big early rivalries in the AAFC.
Big games at Kezar Stadium.
Yes, exactly. Kezar Stadium was the place to be.
And the Browns were dominant. And part of that was because Willis and Motley were so good.
Yes, and Paul Brown actually kept signing more black players after 1946. So he really did things a little differently because a lot of the other teams didn't sign additional black players.
And you contextualize the time with a couple of different issues of racial politics in the United States. One of them is a lynching that took place at this time in Monroe, Georgia. What happened there in 1946?
In 1946, and it really was only a couple weeks before the start of training camp for the LA Rams. So this was going to be the first time that Kenny Washington and Woody Strode were going to be stepping out on the field as members of the Rams. So news hits that there were four black individuals lynched in Monroe. And they had been two black men and two black women, one who had been a service member. They basically got stopped by a number of cars at this bridge, and guys got out of the cars with guns and basically told both the black men and the black women to get out, took them down by the river that the bridge ran over, and shot them. And then the next day, news started to break that this had happened. And one of the things, one of the ghastly things that was particularly common back then as well, is what that did was it drew a lot of lynching souvenir hunters. So people would come in droves just to take pictures of what had happened there. The bodies had been removed, but they would look for artifacts, pieces of rope, you know, shotgun shells, whatever. So that was happening right around the time that these four guys were preparing to play.
So what was it like then for these black men to play pro football in these times?
Well, it was certainly difficult for them to play in these times. A lot of times they didn't get a full shot at playing time, or they were used very intermittently by the coaches. They tended to be fairly isolated on the teams. I know that Bill Willis's sons, two of his sons, talked about how he had several kind of friends on the team who basically said, hey, if anyone on the other team starts bothering you, starts kicking you under the pile, or starts, you know, pulling stuff, calling you names, let us know and we'll, you know, take care. We'll retaliate for you because we know that if you do, you will get kicked out of the game. So it was very hard because they were faced with a lot of abuse, and then they had to focus on playing really well and knowing that we were potential targets for anyone who wanted to make a statement against integration. And then all of these things contextually that were happening around them were things that they had to worry about off the field as well. So there was really no escape from it.
Why did these players, Kenny Washington and his teammate Woody Strode for the LA Rams, along with Marion Motley and Bill Willis for the Cleveland Browns, why aren't they celebrated, do you think, in the same way that Jackie Robinson is? He's a household name.
Yes, and I think part of it is that Jackie Robinson unequivocally overcame the obstacles that were thrown at him by racism, despite his, you know, the personal cost of it to himself. He was Rookie of the Year. He was a league MVP. He won the World Series. So he fulfills this kind of typical American hero narrative. And Kenny Washington and Woody Strode, while they had successful careers over the course of football and post-football, they didn't succeed within the NFL in the same term. So they got signed 7 years late. They were past their prime when they got signed. So their stories couldn't really be told as a complete and unfettered triumph over racism. And for a lot of people, they don't want to reckon with that full cost of racism. So I think those stories, their stories, force people to recognize that a little bit more. And I think that's something that a lot of people still struggle with.
That's Gretchen Atwood, author of the book Lost Champions, Four Men, Two Teams, and the Breaking of Pro Football's Color Line. She spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. In Oakland, at the corner of Broadway and 25th Street, there's a black building painted with the words God's Gym. Inside, owner Gary Shields leads brutal group training sessions that make his clients beg for mercy. KALW's Tammy Drummond went inside and brought back this story of the man behind God's Gym.
Sink it, sink it, sink it. Yep. Two, one more.
I'm on the training floor at God's Gym, and it's definitely old school. One room crammed with barbells, benches, and ancient weight machines. Those painful grunts? That's Brett Sweeney, struggling through a set of squats under the eagle eye of personal trainer Gary Shields.
Sometimes it don't feel like this place matched the name. The pain we go through here.
God's isn't your typical gym. Gary Shields is both a personal fitness trainer and an ordained minister, which accounts for some pretty unconventional gym rules, like
no dating or flirting in the gym.
Try to get that fine man's number while you're waiting for your next set of crunches, and Shields will show you the exit.
The bottom line is, we're here to get in shape and have a family atmosphere.
Shields is not someone you want to mess with. With his massive biceps, he still looks every bit the champion bodybuilder that he used to be back in the 1980s. And he still keeps up a brutal regimen. Shields starts his day at God's just after midnight. He does cardio and stretches. Then he does something that's not part of a typical trainer's handbook.
I start asking God for his wisdom.
Back in 08, Shields could see one of his clients, Renata Gray, was hurting. Her parents had both died within months of each other, and she was 100 pounds overweight.
And I was on the treadmill, and Brother G, as we call him, comes over in his very gentle way, in that deep-toned voice, okay, sis. Okay, sis, so when you want to start working on your health?
Now she's a trim 5 feet five, 140 pounds. She's part of Shields' early bird 3:30 a.m. workout crew. And she's one of many clients who goes to hear his monthly sermons at Living Word Ministries Community Church.
Find your delight in God, and he will give you the desires of your heart.
Shields wasn't always so sanctified. As a teenager in Oakland in the late 70s and early 80s, he was headed for trouble.
I was an angry young man. I had been participating in immoral and illegal, you know, small-time hustles since I was like 13 years old.
But then one day, he discovered weightlifting in a dirty, dusty basement at the Berkeley YMCA. A former Mr. Universe told him he had a bright future as a bodybuilder. So Shields decided to try his luck in an amateur contest in Alameda. The only problem was he had no idea what he was doing.
Well, I didn't know that they had posing trunks, right? So they looked like drawers to me. So I got some black drawers.
He also didn't know that he belonged in the teenage division.
I'm like 19 then, right? And I get up there with all these men, just as bold, in my black drawers with baby all on. And I took seventh place out of 32 men.
2 weeks later, he competed with his own age group. And that time, he got himself some real posing trunks.
I wiped out all those teenagers. And that was it. I was bit by the bug then.
Shields went on to rack up bodybuilding titles. His dream had always been to start his own gym. So in 1985, he opened the Iron Pit in West Oakland. The name was a reference to the weightlifting area in a prison yard. It made sense at the time. A lot of his clients were ex-inmates. Shields built a team of champion bodybuilders, and he went through a life-changing personal transformation.
I embraced the faith in 1987.
But while Shields might have begun to find inner peace, the Iron Pit was surrounded by chaos. Crack hit West Oakland hard in the late 80s.
So my business started going down. I almost went out of business.
He heard that another gym in a safer area downtown was giving up its space at 25th and Broadway. He scraped together the money for the $1,100 a month lease by selling off his old Corvette and other belongings.
By the time I painted everything and, you know, fixed it, put new carpet down, stuff like that, right? I had $8 left. Good job. I just got married, so my wife didn't know I had $8 left. And I walked in that door, and I worked 42 days straight.
As Shields became more deeply involved in his religious faith, he began to feel like the name Iron Pit no longer fit. So he hired a man to paint the front of the building black to cover up the sign.
And I was praying and praying and praying and asking God, you know, what am I gonna put up here? And I just kept hearing God's, you know.
So that's what he named it.
So some folks left. You know what I'm saying? They was tripping. But a whole lot more people came.
Mark Ibanez was one of those people who came. He started working out at God's Gym 9 years ago.
Gotta get a good breathing rhythm going. This elliptical machine.
What is it like to come to a gym with all these religious overtones?
Well, it doesn't bother me at all. I can tell you that nobody pushes anything on you.
Except maybe for more excruciating reps with the barbell. Shields has been helping people change their lives for the better for the past 30 years. All the while, Oakland has continued to change, too.
So all of this is different.
We're standing on Broadway in front of God's Gym. Shields is remembering all the shops that are no more. The tire rim store, the safe shop, Biff's 24-hour restaurant where the pimps used to hang out.
The furniture store here, it was a furniture store. Now they're making it some kind of coffee shop.
An exodus of businesses from San Francisco has driven Oakland's commercial leases through the roof. Uber recently announced that it was moving its headquarters into the old Sears building, just down the road from God's. Many people in Oakland worry that the ride-sharing company's arrival will further overheat the market, leading to more displacement. It's why Shields says,
you know, I'm a big saver. I'm always saving, and prepare for the worst-case scenario.
But even if he has to move one day, Shields doesn't ever worry about going out of business altogether. He says his motto has always been to invest in people and in God. In Oakland, I'm Tammy Drummond for Cross Currents.
That piece originally aired in February of this year. If you've got story ideas you'd like us to follow, tell us about them. Drop us a note at news@kalw.org. Our team includes Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Olivia Henry, Jurgen Klemm, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Andrew Stelzer, Claire Stremple, and Beatrice Thomas. The show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liza Veal. Julie Kane is our managing producer. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Jinx Jones and the King Tones. They'll be at Tupelo on Grant Street in San Francisco this Friday night, and things get started around 9:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Making all the city boys stop and stare. She's a redneck Barbie. Redneck Barbie. She's a redneck Barbie.